this isn't just his story. This is his philosophy on life. Mm. This is the way he sees the world. And his descriptions of these other women and how, and his life and how the world has failed him. Mm-hmm. And then what he decided was actually important in the world and in life and these choices that we make as human beings, and how he came to the conclusion that what he actually wants is a true partner and real love. Mm-hmm. And that that is Jane. There's pieces of that in the adaptions. There's parts of that there. It's that bigger feeling of not just a question that this man is asking this woman, mm-hmm. but a question that Bronte is posing to us as readers is, what should your life be?
Hi, Lillian.
Hi, Piper.
So we were going to read like more than 10 chapters. And
yeah, we were.
Then chapter 27 just kicked our butts. So we're like, this needs its whole episode, right?
Yeah. So this is chapter 27 episode. So if you're listening to these episodes, either you're very obsessed with us, which thank you, I'm so flattered. And so you just remember everything we say, or you're like listening to the book ones in order. We very confidently were going to read it in 6 chunks. This was going to be our 5th chunk, and we were going to get through chapter 27 and then all the St. John chapters. And instead of doing that, we read chapter 27. Then we called each other and went, that's an episode, right?
Yes. Well, it was partially, I think, both us saying this deserves its full episode, which it does. Mm-hmm. But also, luckily, I think we were both vibing on the same level of laziness, where it was literally the day before. And I was like, I only read one of the 15 chapters we were supposed to read. And you're like, same. So same page. Yay.
a little justification for our actions. So I did feel like this chapter was super long, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I had a moment of like, this chapter's super long. I bet it's the longest chapter in the book. That feels like a very Googleable question. So I did Google it, and Google was like, we don't have an answer for you on that, Lillian. And I was like, what else am I going to do with a Saturday night other than figure out exactly how many pages each chapter in Jane Eyre is and put that together in a spreadsheet and then figure out if this is in fact the longest chapter.
Oh, Lillian, I think you've just taken your love of spreadsheets to a new level.
And you're all welcome for it. I'm a big nerd, and that's why you love me.
Hooray, it is. It's why I love you, that's for sure.
So yeah, this is all based off of my copy of the book. I didn't do word count. I did consider doing word count, but that felt like too much. So it's all based off of how many pages there are in the chapters based off of my edition of the book. Mm-hmm. So the average chapter in Jane Eyre has 13 pages. The longest chapter, this chapter, is 27 pages.
Ooh.
So she's a long boy. There's a lot in here. Mm-hmm. I feel a little bit more justified in our choice. And I also have a lot of big feelings about this chapter, but I also learned, because I'm a big nerd, a lot of other cool things about the lengths of chapters. Shortest chapter is the last chapter. Second shortest is the first chapter. This is a fun fact you have now.
I do like that. Yay. We learn things all the time on this show, don't we?
it's Lillian's recurring segment, Things Nobody Asked.
Yay. It's a wonderful, wonderful add to this content. So we've kind of chatted about how we maybe want to start by just sort of like general overall feelings of this, before we dive into kind of chronologically making our way through this man's explanation. So I really appreciated when we talked outside of the podcast about just having this be the sole focus of today's episode, that you mentioned something that I've said a couple of times, which now having read this chapter, boy, is it really solidified for me, the idea that a adaptation and especially our novel here today really depends, the whole thing hinges, I think, on how Rochester explains himself after the truth is revealed. So I think we should save for the very end of this to say whether or not, like how we feel of like, would we go with him? Should we save that for the end?
Like, I was going to ask you like number one question, because I feel like that's the whole chapter. I was like thinking that in my head, and I have lots of big thoughts about but I absolutely can save it if that's what we think we want to do.
Okay. Cause I think we'll get the most authentic answers if we talk through every different kind of stage of this stay speech and kind of go through our reactions to each moment. And then I think overall we can reflect on the whole of it. I think that's kind of how I would like to approach it.
I think you're totally right. I think we'll save that. I do have a couple of things I still want to mention right up top here. Mm-hmm. The first one you've sort of already covered, but just the idea. And Piper was the one who, the first thing she told me about Jane Eyre when we were watching the very first version is she's like, the adaptions live and die, and how you feel about Rochester lives and dies on his stay speech. And that has held true on every adaption we've watched, whether or not he seems like a good guy in a bad situation or a piece of trash, it's his stay speech. Mm-hmm. And I have never felt that to be more true than reading the book, because it has completely changed the way I feel about Rochester as a character, like in every way.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to dive in to know what that statement means for you, because I know what it means for me.
It's like reframed a lot of things for me. And that's part of why I want to have this conversation up top, is to... because it hit me right at the beginning of the chapter, like how this feels different from, and because that's the next thing that I had on my list of things to mention is, I don't think any of the adaptions have truly captured what this chapter is.
Yeah.
And I think it's the most important chapter in the book. And I think it's her thesis. I think this is the point, all of the points she's making in all the other chapters, all of her conversations around religion and relationships and personhood is explored in this chapter.
Yes.
And I can't imagine just mentioning it quick and then talking about all the other things that we were going to read.
Seriously. No, before we sat down to record, I was just kind of skimming back over some of the big chunks. So I had some stuff fresh in my brain. And I think it'd be so interesting if you were like pursuing a degree in like ethics or whatever you would do that for in college, you could do an incredible paper talking about the ethics of this chapter alone and what he tells us and what we take from that.
Absolutely. And I think that there's enough in here that like I would watch, I don't think this is, there's enough of an audience to do this for, but like I would watch a one act play that was just this chapter. Like I would watch two people spend an hour exploring this chapter, which is why you can't, like, I don't know how you would do this right in an adaption, honestly. And I don't remember the details of it enough to feel like I know this, but I'm excited. I'm even more excited to watch the 83 now, because I think they're the closest.
That's what I was thinking the whole time I was reading this, is I'm like, okay, of all the versions we've seen, I think that one takes the most kind of direct quotes from this chapter. There's obviously still so much that they cut, because of course you have to, otherwise it's going to be at least a 20-minute scene. But yeah, I felt like there was a lot here that the 80s one does that other movies don't take the time for. Yeah.
Yeah. And how could, none of the movies could do that, but like, yeah. The mini series, even like we can't go into that too much now because we'd lose our minds. But like the 2006 is like so different. And yet I think as I was reading this, I could feel the heart of that in here. Like there's parts of it where there's a level of truth to the intimacy of that scene, of them being that close together.
Yeah.
That you can't capture that without that when you're talking about it in a TV show.
Yeah. I also completely agree with your thought about the one act play, because I was thinking of that, not necessarily just a one act, but I think a theater production could really give this scene kind of the time and focus that it deserves. That would be very fascinating. And again, I told Lillian this, that I've put out a Google notification for the words Jane Eyre and Minnesota. So if we ever get a notification in my inbox that there is a community theater like up in Fargo doing a production of Jane Eyre, Lillian and I are road tripping to see it. So that may happen someday. Cross your fingers for us, listeners.
We had some very kind people reach out to us and go, hey, we can get you free tickets to see our production of Jane Eyre. And I was like, that's amazing. And they're like, yeah, so just tell us which location in England is going to be the easiest for you. And I was like, oh, none of them.
Oh, boo. But thank you anyway. That's so kind.
I have one big structural thing that is like part of the framework that is really the crux of what I was mentioning at the beginning of something about this is different for me in the way I see Rochester. Mm-hmm. But before I talk about that, do you have other big thoughts that you want to reference before we go into?
I think one of the things that really stands out to me is, I think a a significant amount of the length of this chapter is mm-hmm. just dedicated to him talking. There's mm-hmm. not a lot of Jane response. It's a lot of him talking and her listening. Mm-hmm. And again, what's so interesting to me about the way that Charlotte Bronte writes this without, you know, describing much of what he's physically doing, it's kind of just relying on his words. So it's left up to us kind of imaginative types to picture, what is he doing as he's telling this long story? Is he mm-hmm. pacing throughout the room? Is he kneeling down and taking her hands? Is he gesturing wildly? Is he being very composed? I feel like there's a lot of that that you can kind of fill in for yourself. Mm-hmm. What we don't give, we can kind of fill in and kind of imagine what he possibly could be doing. So without having any sense of like tempo of how he's like saying these words, the passion that is conveyed, there was a lot of this, it felt to me as if he was very kind of very quickly saying a lot and just kind of dumping it on her, of being like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and you might think this, but you're wrong because then this was a thing. Mm-hmm. And I really sensed this kind of, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? That he was like just so frantic and desperate, I think, yeah. to just be like, please hear everything I have to say. And lucky for him, Jane sits and listens and mm-hmm. seems to absorb everything that he has to give her. So that's one thing that really struck me, is the way that I kind of read this is him very frantically dumping a lot on her lap. And she's just like, okay, I'm trying to sort through everything and make up my mind about all the details you've given me.
And I think what the piece of that is missing to me in the adaptions, and I don't know if you can see that if you've read this chapter, and so in some ways we're missing it, but I am also a big believer that if you're going to say this is Jane Eyre, it should be Jane Eyre whether or not I've read the book. Mm-hmm. So I understand that I'll probably see more of that as I have this context to bring into those spaces, but none of them have been able to do it without me having read this. Right. But I think that frantic desperation of like all those things, I think the layer that is not in the adaptions that is here is, this isn't just his story. This mm-hmm. is his philosophy on life. Mm. This is the way he sees the world, and his descriptions of these other women and how, and his life and how the world has failed him. Mm-hmm. And then what he decided was actually important in the world and in life, and these choices that we make mm-hmm. as human beings, and how he came to the conclusion that what he actually wants is a true partner and real love. Mm. And that is Jane. Mm. There's pieces of that in the adaptions. There's parts of that there, but that bigger feeling of not just a question that this man is asking this woman, mm-hmm. but a question that Bronte is posing to us as readers is, what should your life be?
Yeah. Wow.
And this chapter is both of these characters exploring that idea.
Absolutely.
And wow. And I think that the thing that shifted for me is that realization of mm-hmm. kind of both of these characters answering the question of what should your life be and who should get to decide that.
Yeah.
And then also the shift for me is, I think so often I'm so used to reading things from the male gaze, mm-hmm. which the male gaze versus the female gaze is something we've talked about before, not in depth, but I think that one of the things that struck me right off the bat in this was how much this was a man speaking, but he was written by a woman.
Yeah. And
how I interpret the things that he's saying differently, mm-hmm. knowing that they're coming from a woman. So even though Rochester is the one describing these other women who are not, Jane's not like other girls, which I know we've talked about during an episode on that, and we definitely will.
Yes.
But I think that that's where I see this differently, is it is, even though it's a man saying the words, it's not a man commenting on what a woman is and what she should be and why Jane is better than those mm-hmm. women. Because I don't yeah. like that.
Right. No,
it's agreed. Charlotte Bronte saying, mm-hmm. what is the difference between a man, these other women that Rochester didn't connect with and didn't mm-hmm. want to keep and weren't what he was looking for in life, mm-hmm. Jane. And the innocence really changes for me with that frame, because he yeah. is so obsessed with her innocence.
Yes.
And that has always ooped me out.
Yes.
But I think when I reframe it that way for myself, mm-hmm. instead of seeing it as this older man who wants a young girl who he can influence and mm-hmm. mold. Mm-hmm. If I flip it to, this is a young woman who has not been influenced and molded by a society that he thinks is inherently wrong. Mm-hmm. He's arguing that the world is wrong.
Yeah.
And that only people who have either been so wronged by it, like him, mm-hmm. or someone who has not yet been pushed into a box, mm-hmm. can really see each other in it. And so that's his argument in my mind in this chapter.
I love that that's your interpretation of that, Lillian. That's really beautiful. I found myself being a little caught up when he chose to mention the other women that he had been with before then kind of, you know, opening mm-hmm. his heart more to Jane. I felt that was kind of untactful and like rude, because it almost felt to me as if, like, in a modern setting, it'd be some guy bragging about all these other ladies that he had been with to be like, oh, but they're all dirty skanks and I want to be with someone who's good mm-hmm. like you.
Yeah.
But I love that what stood out to me from that kind of moment in comparison is Jane using that information in the way that he talked about those women mm-hmm. to then kind of guard herself by, I don't know if I can trust him mm-hmm. that he will still see me as this perfect, like, yeah. innocent person. I could, if I go with him and I risk it all, I could become in his mind like these other women yeah. now are. And I think that's such a big part of how she decides to do what she does. So I love that you see the beauty in that, of what he's trying mm-hmm. to say. But I also am very keenly aware of kind of what the caution that Jane also draws from this choice that he makes to talk about these other people.
I find it so interesting that in so many ways, you and I came in to this chapter with like the opposite preconceived notions and then yeah. came back out with the reason why we were wrong. I just think that, like, if we both know, I know enough about you to know that in general, you've always been a big fan of age gap romance. And yeah. I have always been like, gross. And so the idea that, like, I went into this going, I'm not going to like it when he says you're a young, innocent thing that I can, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I just find that so fascinating. I want us to get into the chapter. The way that I structured it for my own notes in my own mind is this very like chunked out, like I see it as like four phases of the chapter.
Yeah.
The first one being Rochester going, Jane, you have to hear me out. Like mm-hmm. that desperation that you're talking about. Then Rochester explaining his life story, which we have pages yes. of almost nothing from Jane. Mm-hmm. And then the please stay and here's the story of like you and I and why I love you and why this is special and what life should be.
Yeah.
And then the final part, which rips my heart out, is Jane's no.
Yes. Yes. It's so powerful and amazing. And it's like, this chapter is why this story has been adapted 1,000 times.
And it's why it will continue to be forever, because I think we've both talked about the idea that we're absolutely loving this book. I love the way that we've come to this book. I think that it's, first of all, hilarious. Second of all, we were like, let's watch a bunch of adaptions and have a podcast and be almost a year into that podcast and finish the book.
I think it's given us some wonderful perspective. But so if we want to kind of tackle this by chunks. Mm-hmm. So for chunk one, there's a few details that I just made notes on that I thought were really cool. Great. And interesting.
Love it.
So, you know, Jane's up in her room. She's kind of talking to herself. She's sort of like figuring out what she's going to do. And above all, she has this thought that just says you need to leave Thornfield. And so mm-hmm. she realizes she hasn't eaten or had anything to drink and she's really weak. So she opens the door and she kind of stumbles and he is there waiting for her and he catches her. And which is, again, I think a scene that I feel the 80s version with Timmy D kind mm-hmm. of most closely did, because I always thought it was really funny that in that version, it seems as if he's got his leg out intentionally trying to trip her right. so he can catch her. And like, so that's kind of how I read that scene, even though she didn't specifically say he tripped me. He does mm-hmm. catch her. He does carry her down the stairs. He does bring her wine and stuff and be like, here, drink. Like, oh, you're so weak. Let me take care of you and all this wonderful stuff. And I'm like, ooh, I like it. In that part where she's first kind of like talking to herself, kind mm-hmm. of reasoning things out, she makes a mention about plucking out an eye and losing a hand, and that's obvious.
Whoa,
yeah,
I just fully missed that.
Yeah, no, that's like insane foreshadowing. I think it's like the second time in the story in which either she or Rochester has made reference to, in the very least, being blind and her kind of leading him.
Yes.
But she makes this reference to herself when being like, if I could but take these things away from me, blah, blah, blah. So I thought that was interesting foreshadowing. There's also, while she's thinking over all of these things, she refers to Thornfield as haunted. And I thought that was so wonderful and beautiful that this kind of motif carries over now that we know the truth. Because mm-hmm. for someone who doesn't, who's come into the story blind, not to make reference to Rochester again, but the idea when you first don't know what's happening and there's sort of this allusion to maybe it's something supernatural, to then, once we know the truth, that's even almost more scary than, you know, if it was something like spooky or fake. And the idea that Thornfield is haunted, but not by a ghost, but simply by the sad memories of this awful situation. So I thought that was beautiful and I loved that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think this first little chunk here, the whole chapter breaks my heart, right? Mm-hmm. Like the whole thing is just truly heartbreaking. And I think we talked about on our last book episode that those last few pages of the chapter prior to this were such an incredible depiction of like what it feels like to be depressed.
Yeah.
And Rochester is like, please be mad at me. Please scream and cry and sob and throw things at me. And all of this stuff is like the resignation he doesn't know how to even handle, because it's this person who's so full of life that he loves having yeah. all of that drained away. Mm-hmm. And that's devastating to listen to him like beg her to scream at him.
Yeah.
Especially since she has just had this moment, and I'm so glad that it didn't carry through. Like, I'm so glad she didn't keep thinking that he didn't love her. Mm-hmm. But the fact that she was like, you wouldn't have treated me this way if you really loved me. And for him to come back and immediately be like, no, that of course I love you. And here's all the reasons why. And for it to just immediately in a way that feels real mm-hmm. and not like, and then he said, sorry. So I forgave him and now we're fine.
Like, yeah.
In a way that feels real as he's like expressing these things of like wanting her to be that full version of herself. And she says, in as he like asks for her forgiveness, she says in her head, reader, I forgave him in that moment and on the spot. There was deep remorse in his eyes, such true pity in his tone, such manly energy in his manner. And besides, there was such unchanged love in his whole look and mine. I forgave him all, yet not in words, not outwardly, only in my heart's core.
Yeah, which I think is the first sort of glimpse into the palpable, this awful tug of war that's happening for Jane in this moment of she's like, I've already forgiven you, but I need to push you away. Like that she loves him so much that she mm-hmm. understands what he's been through, but that her moral compass and I think sense of self-respect won't allow her to indulge in loving him or telling him or letting him love her.
Well, and I think that like I mentioned at the beginning, that crux of this chapter is these two people, mm-hmm. what should your life be? And who yeah. gets to decide what that is? And Jane thinks that there is a moral right, that there is a right way to live your life. And that no matter, there's that paragraph, no matter what he says, she's gonna leave. There's nothing he can say in this chapter, in these pages,
yeah.
that is going to convince her to stay, because loving him isn't a good enough reason to stay. Forgiving him isn't a good enough reason to stay. Understanding him isn't a good enough reason. Yeah. It is wrong in her eyes. She sees it as morally wrong to do this and to be with him because of all of these reasons that she has, these structures that she believes in mm-hmm. and thinks get to decide who does what, when, and why.
Yeah.
And Rochester has had these experiences that we're going to hear and understand that he doesn't think that's enough. He mm-hmm. doesn't think other people get to decide how you live your life.
Right. Yeah. No, it's so fascinating. I think this element here of Jane making up her mind kind of right then and there, you know, we can argue that back and forth of whether or not it could ever fluctuate, but of her being like, I'm going to leave him and that's that. And his kind of, what really stands out to me about this is there's a power flip here. Mm-hmm. I think up until this moment, he has held all the power. He's mm-hmm. the one with the information. He's the one playing games with the secrets. Yes, she has an influence over him with the way that he loves her, but mm-hmm. he always was in control. In this moment, he has lost that. Jane is the one who can decide whatever's going to happen next. And that's where his desperation comes from, I think, is realizing that he is, you know, at her whim. And he's like, this is my chance. If I can maybe appeal to her, if I can seduce her, if I can convince her, then we can be together and I will be okay. But the fact that it's like she will make that decision and she's already kind of made it, I think, mm-hmm. is so powerful and interesting. And I love, it's something that I think we talked about the most in the Sandeel episode, is when he kind of like talks about this, like, I could have your body, but I wouldn't have mm-hmm. your soul, which I can maybe, if you want to save that part for later when we get to that chunk of the story. But even then, he has this moment of like, I could use my strength against you. Mm-hmm. But even then, he wouldn't actually be the one yeah. in control of the situation. And it's so interesting to see this powerful man reduced to this. And I think that's part of what scares him so much.
And I think I completely agree with you. I think there's that he doesn't have control over this. And that is part of the reason why he's been doing all of this lying, is that he knew that this was going to be a point where he would lose this control. And that by keeping those secrets, that was the only way he was able to keep that. And he's had so little control. Cause like all these other stories, he's not, you think of Rochester as this powerful man in the society where rich landowning white men are the ones who get to have all of the control and all of the power. They're the only ones in this structure who have power. And we see how all of those systems are also preventing him from having real control over his life. Mm-hmm. Because his brothers and his father had control. And then so much of that control, even though she didn't gain any control, went to Bertha. Mm-hmm. Bertha's sheer existence made it so that he no longer had control over his life. And then we see him trying to regain that control by saying, I don't want any of these things in society anyway. Mm-hmm. And these months back at Thornfield with Jane, he's desperate to keep that control and it's all gone. And she has all of it. And control doesn't mean that you get what you want. Mm-hmm. And what Jane wants is to be with Rochester.
Right.
But her choices in life, no matter what he says here, it's the opposite of a miscommunication trope, right? Like the rest of the book, you could argue it was like an intentional miscommunication. Like he is actively keeping information from her. And this is, it's not that we don't understand each other. We do. We completely, by the end of this chapter, they both completely understand the position the other is in.
Yeah.
And it's still not going to work.
Oh, it's so amazing. It's so amazing. So I've got some notes about when he starts telling his story. Do you have things from before that you want to chat about before we start to get into him sort of explaining things?
I'm glancing just to make sure. Sorry. Oh, I just wrote really good plan around the paragraph where he's like, I'm just going to lock her in the attic and it's going to be fine. Great job, dude.
Smart.
They talk a lot about like what they're going to do with Adele. And then the last thing that I kind of have in the section of like, you have to listen to me, like you have to just sit down and listen, is can he, that desperation, that like frantic, crazy man who was waiting outside of her door. Mm-hmm. When he says the words, can you listen to me? And she says, yes, sir, for hours.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then she sits there and it's.
And she does.
And she goes from the hollow, frantic, sad, all those big feelings. She goes from that, sees all the feelings in him, resolves that feeling of like, okay, he did love me. This wasn't all a lie, mm-hmm. but I still have to do this thing. And we see her fall into that calm, strong woman that we see.
I think one thing that's really interesting though, before she falls into the calm, strong woman, there is a moment when I think his passions are getting a little too high and it mm-hmm. kind of freaks her out. And she's like, that's when I allowed my tears to fall because I knew it would calm him. Mm. And that was a moment that also doubled for me as both like, yes, this is really cute, but I was totally thinking of what you were saying from another recent version that we watched of this idea of, you know, the flight, fight, feign, things like that, of like, if you are not in a safe space, fawn. Right. Like, how do you protect yourself? And that almost felt like a fawning thing for me of her being like, I really need you to calm down right now, and I don't know how to do that, so I'm just going to get real sad, and that seems to be working. Okay, I'm relaxed now, too. Let's move forward. So that was a really interesting moment.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I also think what a classic example of women. I feel like one of the biggest cons of the society is that women are the more emotional ones, because this is like, in a very real way, an example of women are the ones who are in control of our emotions. Jane is the one in control of her emotions in this chapter, because she has to be, because if she's not, she's going to get locked in the attic for being crazy. Nobody's locking Rochester in an attic and he's being crazy.
Seriously. Okay. So yes, we moved on to the part now where he's explaining the story. She's going to listen to him for hours. Okay. So just some like basic highlights in case you're unfamiliar. He tells us about how he like just got out of college and his dad, who was like a money seeker or wanted to make sure that all of his sons had cash, because even though his eldest son, not Rochester, was going to inherit everything and seemed pretty great, he's like, no, my dad couldn't bear the idea that I would like not be of stature. So he's like, I have to find a wealthy lady for my son. So therefore they're like, we arranged a marriage for you with this hot babe down in Jamaica. She is the talk of Spanish town. And they fly him out there, sail him out there. And he talks about how it's a line that I've seen in many adaptations where it's like, yes, they showed her off to me at parties, but we were never alone together. And so we start to see the seeds of sort of this, how his family and her family sort of were together in this sort of deception of getting him to marry her, and about how, you know, she was very desired by others, and the fact that she was interested in him made him feel special. And he talks a lot about how naive he was at the time, that he was so flattered to have this like special person think he was cool, and that he kind of fell for her. And he has a line, and I don't know the exact words, I didn't write it down, but something where he's like, I thought that I loved her, even though I didn't know what that meant and never experienced it before. But so he's like, before I knew what happened, we were suddenly married. And that's kind of when her true nature sort of comes forward to him. He starts talking about like the truth of her mother's mental history, which was kept secret from him, that she was also insane and locked away somewhere, and that this was now being showed to him through Bertha. So a lot of the stuff that stood out to me from this is how he talks about how vulgar she is. And there were a lot of little details that were dropped here that I found so interesting that I wish we had seen in other stories. The fact that she is 4 years older than him is interesting to me. And he describes her a couple of times as being like this very tall and rather like sturdy woman. And so what I'm almost picturing, like a doe-eyed, like young Rochester, like is now with this very like confident, loud, intense woman. And maybe he like doesn't feel like he knows how to kind of be like, okay, like calm down, lady. Like, so I don't know, her vulgarity, it sounded almost like it really scared him. And like the way he describes those things are kind of vague. And I think that's, again, something that's for the audience perspective, we can fill that in. Like, how do we interpret that ourselves? Like, is she throwing stuff at him? Is she cursing him up and down, saying nasty things that he doesn't like? Like, I would be so curious to kind of see that scene interpreted, like on stage or something, to be like, wow, how much Bertha is too much for Rochester? Like, I kind of want to know.
I think if we're talking about the ones we've already seen, I think the one that actually tries to show us that is the 2006, where we see a lot of flashbacks of Bertha and her like cheating on him and then like staring at him in the eyes while she
banging another dude and like locking eyes with Rochester. I'm
like, this is on purpose to hurt you. Like, but I also, one thing that we're not going to unpack today, and I actually am pretty excited, something that's on our list, but we probably won't get to for a while. We've had a couple of listeners recommend a book that is written from Bertha's perspective, and it is Bertha's story. And I'm really excited to get into that.
Yes.
But something that I believe that addresses that is not going to get addressed on our podcast today is Bertha is a Black woman. Like, that's how she's described. So there's a lot of problematic things in that description of this character. We're not going to address that today.
Right. Although, and I only know this from the other podcast that I listened to prior to this of, so the Hot and Bothered podcast had a season about Jane Eyre. And when they were talking about this section, they debated back and forth whether or not, because Bertha is described as Creole and she's described as dark, but there's some debate about whether or not she is actually like a person of color. Because there are white Creole people and there's all kinds of other stuff. So that is kind of up in the air for discussion. We'd have to do research to talk about that.
Which I think we've talked about doing an episode specifically talking about Bertha. Like all of these things are things that deserve their own conversation.
Right.
I only wanted to call it out here because if you do read it as a black woman, this chapter's super fucking racist.
Yes. Yes. Because he does have a line where he's like, her family had money and I was desirable for like my race. Like that's something that he says, that word is used. And I'm like, oh no, wait, what are you talking about? So
we're not going to unpack that today. We'd have to have done a lot more research on that to do that. I just want to, you know, per always bring a little bit of a downer.
Well, you know, if it keeps people informed and educated, that's okay.
Yeah.
One thing also, in addition to, so the two things that really stand out to me from this is he lived with her for 4 years in Jamaica. Enduring however we interpret this vulgar abuse that he describes, which I do really feel for him in that. Cause I'm trying, if I put myself in a situation where I'm like, I'm in a foreign country, I'm married to someone who has dedicated their lives to being in the very least very mean to me. And in the very worst, actively like aggressive and cruel and other stuff. And he's like, I like how he describes the thin walls of the house that they share. He can hear her screaming all the time. Like she's just constantly just kind of like raging and it wears on his nerves, which of course it would. So I feel a sympathy for him in these scenes personally. I also think it's really interesting how often when he mentions her madness, it's not uncommon that it's followed up with him talking about, he brings in elements of his own morals of how to treat that. He's like, I wouldn't lock her away. That's cruel. I wouldn't hit her back. That's not who I am. He talks about wanting to keep her healthy and safe despite the way that she treats him. And I think that is something that gives like so many bonus points to Rochester in my mind in these moments, is when he considers Bertha while also enduring the suffering that she is putting upon him.
And I think for this conversation, we're going to assume that Bertha is like abusive to him or, and is crazy. Like that's the conceits that we're making as we read this, even though we're reading it from his perspective.
Right.
I think with those conceits, I completely agree with you. And I also think it's always interesting to me when someone answers questions that aren't asked, like, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Why didn't it's because they've been asked before. It's because those were the suggestions he was getting. So one of the things, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't actually have the line in front of me. He says the only way to deal with her cruelty is to answer it with my own cruelty. And I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
I think that is exactly the point that you're making there, where it's like, that gives me a lot of credit to Rochester, because he's basically saying like, I could have beat the shit out of her and maybe she would have listened to me. Like that's the advice that like her dad and her brother were giving me. Cause that's who he's getting advice from without a man. Right. Like,
yeah,
this is the only people who know about this that he talks to are her brothers and her dad. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, you just got to beat them. And then they'll listen to you.
Poor Bertha. Yikes. I mean, she's really fortunate. Probably if we are to believe everything he says and that her mental state was then what he says it was. She was fortunate to have someone who wouldn't hit her and lock her away.
Very, very rarely do I go, what a fortunate girl this Bertha Mason for marrying Rochester.
I know. But in a perfect world, she could just be a single crazy lady and go off and bang and swear at whoever she wants.
Or, you know, get help for her mental illnesses.
That too. Though I don't think those services existed back then.
Yes. But I think one of the big things that I want to talk about within this section, because I think it's what leads into the catalyst of Rochester sort of deconstructing what a life should be. Because he is very much, he talked a lot at the beginning, we've seen him talk before about being Jane's equal. And I think this is Rochester as Jane's equal, right? Like he sees the structures, he's going to live within them and he's going to be the best version of himself within what society expects of him.
Yeah.
And he hits this point of hopelessness. And I think that that is such an interesting way to make that the catalyst of change. Because he was living with her for 4 years. Like, I don't feel like they may have mentioned it. I don't feel like the other adaptions have like captured that for me in a way of like, it's not even just his dad and his brother dying. Like, they die, but that's not the thing that sends him back to England. The thing that sends him back is this moment of hopelessness. And I don't want to, suicide is incredibly tragic, and I never ever want to romanticize that. And I also don't want to romanticize having any sort of mental health issues. Those are very real, very big problems that have had impacts on my life and on the life of people that I love. There's a feeling of hopelessness that I don't want to upset anyone, but I related to the idea of having this moment of, I can't, whatever this is, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I've never been suicidal, but I did have a full-fledged mental breakdown 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And what I did with that was completely change everything about my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's really, really interesting to read a description of someone having that experience without using those terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
150 years ago or 100 and more than that, right? Like, it's so interesting to read that the way that he goes through that catalyst moment of, this life is hell. Like, that is what he says when he's like, I don't want to be a good moral person based off of this Christian ideal anymore, because the suffering I'm going through now is worse than anything you could inflict on me in the next life.
And I think, so all of this incredible points, I'm literally, you're giving me an epiphany right now, because I was thinking earlier about how we're describing this suffering that Rochester has endured. And we know from reading the book, the suffering that Jane endured in her childhood. And I think it's so interesting that they both kind of reached a point in their lives and they kind of took different paths on their answer to it, where Rochester said, fuck the rules. I'm going to do what I want and I'm going to go off and do these things. Where Jane turned to kind of this like faith-based, like ethics sort of thing. And she said, I'm going to turn the other cheek, like love thy enemy, and I'm going to power on. And that's what I'm going to do. And I think then they come at this moment here where he's telling this story and he's like, he's like, we're at this crossroads and you and I are so similar. Surely we're going to make the same choice. And she's like, but my beliefs are different. Like the way like you said, the way that she views the world and how she interacts with it is going to lead her down a different path.
And I think there's a million different things. Like, we could spend an hour just talking about why these two characters made such different choices with similar kind of ingredients. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the biggest, there's a lot of big influences is who the people they had in their life were, because Jane had Helen and Miss Temple.
Yes.
And Rochester had his father and brothers and Bertha and all these people who, they weren't an example of what you should be, but they were an example of people who weren't living ethical lives and were getting more of what they wanted out of life than he was.
Yeah.
So the idea that you get rewarded for being a good person, he saw that and was like, no, this is nothing. Mm-hmm. And Jane saw examples of be a good person, even in garbage circumstances, because that's what the people I want to be like do.
Yeah. And it's so interesting too, what you just said about like his examples of how to be come from like his father and his brother, who are actively members of the society that we know Rochester hates. And that's now, because of this chapter, we can see the deeper levels of that. Like, this is why he hates the frickin' laws of society, more so than just because it won't allow him to commit bigamy, but because the people who follow these rules and still get praised as like well-to-do noble folk are total assholes and are getting away with awful stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The getting away with awful stuff. I think it's not even following the rules of society. Mm-hmm. It's manipulating the rules of society.
There we go.
It's you get to have what you want. You don't have to be morally good. You don't have to follow what the right thing to do is. Mm-hmm. You can manipulate within these rules of society what it is that you want to do and still get what you want. I think another layer within this as well is the layers of privilege that play into this.
Yes.
Rochester is a rich white man who can put his wife in a castle with a caretaker and fuck off around Europe and do literally nothing except for look for a woman to love.
Yep.
Jane is a poor orphan woman who is stuck at a school that doesn't feed her. And so they have, that's like this really, she has fewer options. Jane's option for that moment when Jane leaves Willwood, that's the same moment that Rochester had when he left to go to Europe.
Yeah.
Jane's course to freedom was to become a governess. Mm-hmm. And she is living a much freer life than most women in her circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And most people in general, given, you know, the other layers of privilege she has.
Right.
And Rochester got to do whatever he wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Jump around from mistress to mistress. Mm-hmm. Which, you saying that again, Lillian, that makes her decision to leave, like, there's so many levels to this, mm-hmm. of what she's walking away from, apart from the best bits, which is spending a life with a man who loves you. Mm-hmm. There's also, yeah, she, instead of staying in comfort where he's like, I have this villa, on the Mediterranean, we will go there. I'll provide for you. It's going to be great. We'll be away from anyone who knows us. So it's not even like we're cheating. Like, it's totally fine. And instead, because of her moral choice, she is now, as we know, about to go like begging on the moors and be like distraught without anything. And it's like, oh, there's so much temptation there.
And I think it also poses this question, which I think we will address more in the next chunk, mm-hmm. of to do the right thing, like just like objectively, you've decided this is the right thing to do. What do you morally have to give up to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know that Jane's plan is to survive leaving Thornfield.
Oh, really? Interesting.
I want to explore that more. I don't think her plan is to die. I don't think she's intending to die,
mm-hmm.
but she does not have a plan, and that's not going to stop her.
Yeah.
She's not leaving for something. She is leaving is the only moral right that she can find. Mm-hmm. So she will do that whatever the cost. And the cost is her heart and her body and her mind.
Yes. I also think a big part of that, without the kind of foresight of what's coming next, mm-hmm. and simply focusing on the now, I think a big part of it is she's like, if I stay, I will give in to him. I will stay with him.
Oh, for
and
sure.
Yeah, I can only say no so many times. So I need to simply leave so I don't fall to that. And mm-hmm. we'll just see what happens.
There's so much more in this chapter to explore as well. I think there's some moments of the way he talks about pity that I specifically pulled out, and slightly before that moment of hopelessness, but the idea that he's probably experienced pity from people who have heard about this or have any level of awareness of it, or he's seen people have pity for different reasons that are often I'm better than you, so I feel sorry for you.
Yeah.
And the way that he describes Jane's pity as different is, your pity, my darling, is the suffering of a mother's love. It is anguish. It is the pain of the divine passion. I accept it, Jane. Let the daughter have freedom at Advent. My arms wait to receive her. That he wants her pity is mm-hmm. the point of that idea. That like other people's pity comes from a place of, I'm better than you, and what a sad, sad life you're living. At least I'm not you, sir. Bing, 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 with like little finger guns. But Jane's pity comes from someone who truly cares about you, sees your pain, feels your pain. And mm-hmm. that's what her pity is for you.
I also think in this moment where she's been listening this whole time, right? Mm-hmm. And she's kind of like sort of closed herself off emotionally, it seems, at least to him, to protect herself from breaking down and giving in. I think for him, he's like just kind of desperate for any emotional reaction. He's mm-hmm. like, I will gladly have your pity if that means that you're open up to me. Like, cause I just want us to express to one another how we feel and to see each other and feel the same things.
So we talked about this a little bit, but I know you mentioned the two other women. I don't know that we've heard about in any other adaptation.
I have,
curious. You mentioned a little bit about what your thoughts were on that. What do you think of him bringing up these other women? What do you think his intention was there, and Charlotte's intention as well? Like zooming out a little bit and thinking of the author.
So if I'm first thinking about Rochester, I think what he's trying to do is a you're not like other girls thing of saying he's like, no, let me show you how much I love you because I was with these other people and they all sucked in comparison. But you're not like that. You're special. You're unique, which I feel like nowadays that trick wouldn't work on me. But when I was younger, definitely to be told like, oh, you're so special. Be like, yay, I am the best. Like, so I can see why that would be a tactic. And that's kind of what I think he's doing. I don't know from that perspective too, if I'm zooming out to Bronte, I almost, especially with the time this was written, I kind of am tempted to be like, well, it might've been her own sort of like internalized misogyny of this, like Jane's not like other girls trope. And that's why it's mentioned. But I think it's so crucial to the plot, what I was saying before about, I think if he told his whole story and left out this thing about the other ladies and how he thinks of them now, maybe Jane would have stayed with him. I don't know. But because that thing, I think the catalyst for me, which is I think the next chunk that I'm going to really discuss in depth, is her self-value. And if that will be destroyed, if she will forfeit that to stay with him. And by him saying that these other women that he loved and at the time devoted himself to are now seen as trash in his mind, there's now no guarantee that Jane's holy perfectness will stay the same in his mind in the future.
I completely agree. I'm really excited to talk about that. I think for me, the intention with these other women is for sure that you're not like other girls of it all. But I also think that it's a way to talk about what the different kinds of women that Rochester could have were like.
She had two successors, an Italian, Giacinta, and a German, Clara, both considered singularly handsome. What was their beauty to me in a few weeks? Giacinta was unprincipled and violent. I tired of her in 3 months. Clara was honest and quiet, but heavy, mindless, and unimpressible. Not one whit to my taste. I was glad to give her a sufficient sum to set her up in a good line of business and so get decently rid of her.
Yeah, so to me, I don't know how much of a commentary on like it's almost a commentary on like the other women in the world at the time. Like this, they're all gorgeous, right? Like Bertha is supposed to be beautiful. Blanche, who we know is beautiful. We've got Celine, who's beautiful. And then these two other women who are beautiful. They're all gorgeous. And for one reason or another, either they just don't care about the things that Rochester cares about. And I think that it's that I want to be clear, and I feel like I've mentioned this. I don't like the romanticizing suffering. I think this book does that a bit. I think that there is a way that people who have suffered view the world differently. And I think that that's the point that he's trying to make. I think you can have that depth of understanding of the world without suffering.
Yeah.
But I think that that's the point that he's making, is that these women are not necessarily in control of things. They have very few options for themselves, and they're not worried about, they probably don't have the luxury to sit around and worry about moral goods and what the world should be and have these deep intellectual conversations. It's not their biggest interest, because I think most of these women are worried about survival. But Jane, who is really not like other girls in this, in that, she maybe should worry about survival, like a little bit, honey bun. but she has like been at the worst possible place you can be at. Nobody liked her. She had no love, no food, no shelter. Like, she knows what it is to have money and privilege, and then to have not those things, but acceptance. And she knows which one she'd pick. And I think that that's the point that Rochester is trying to make. So that you can be beautiful and this perfect idea of what I should want. And I still don't want those women because they got boring. And instead, I found this plain looking woman who had a depth of life inside of her that was so much more than anything I'd ever seen before, and was in fact what I was looking. I was looking for the wrong things because I was too focused on external beauty. And then I found you, and oh my God. And Jane doesn't hear that.
Right. I think it's, again, this could be an entire episode of just kind of analyzing sort of it's sort of a discussion of class, I think, where if you are set up in this luxury and yes, you don't have to suffer, worry, or do these things, then your priorities, your interests are going to automatically be different. I think where these women maybe are, you know, rich in the quality of their life, Jane is rich in the spirituality of hers. Like, because, like, similar to Rochester, she's had all of these, like, all these occasions to have her think about these deeper things. Mm-hmm. Whereas, again, in the society that Rochester so detests, where these women, in order to function in said society and survive in their own way, they kind of need to play those parts and fit into mm-hmm. those roles. Those are the people who climb that ladder. Yeah. And find themselves happy, quote unquote, and, you know, provided for. And so he's like, the people who climb that ladder, I don't like them. That's what I discovered is, yeah, if you're kind of just that surface level, that's not what I want. And Jane is kind of deeper than that because, you know, she doesn't have to sit around and talk about hats and parties and be like, oh, well, you know, far off places and the ethics of God and all this jazz. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, rad, let's talk about it.
It's one of the things that I've talked about a lot, you know, because you and I are friends, that I've been doing a lot of questioning in my own life recently. And that's a whole other conversation for a different podcast, guys. One of the things that I talk about a lot is the idea of we are so often, and I specifically know it, I had this issue, checking off boxes on a list we didn't write.
Right.
And I think that that's what all of these other people that Rochester sees doing. Mm-hmm. He sees everyone in society. He sees Blanche doing it. He sees his father and brother doing it. Like his father's obsession with money and wealth and power. Mm-hmm. Like why he had this moment of clarity where he went, why does any of this matter? And Jane at a really young age was forced to see people succeed at that and be garbage people, and people who quote unquote failed at that be the best versions of humanity that she saw. And yeah. So that's where Jane is not like other girls.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it so much. So we're about at an hour. I want to talk about the section that I bookmarked that was kind of, I think, the most powerful for me. Okay. So it's here at this moment. It's kind of like one of the last things, like big kind of discussions that Jane has sort of battling with her inner angels and demons about the choice that she will make. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's on 369. The paragraph before talks about her sort of weighing, like, what if she gives in? It's kind of thinking of Rochester. Mm-hmm. There's a line where it says, think of his misery, think of his danger, look at his state. And she asks these big questions, which I think we as a modern audience often ask from a first time viewing, who in the world cares? Who will be injured by what you do? And that's an argument that Rochester makes of saying mm-hmm. this crime technically hurts no one. It's rules written by man based on this kind of Christian like belief system. If we mm-hmm. love each other and that's the truth, then that's what we should act upon. Mm-hmm. And Jane's reaction to that, and I think what helps really solidify what she's going to do going forward, is this section here. And I love in my book, the first word of this is I, and it's italicized to give emphasis. Yes. And I love it so much. And it says, still indomitable was the reply. I care for myself. The more solitary, the more friendless, the more unsustained I am, the more I will respect myself. I will keep the law given by God, sanctioned by man. I will hold to the principles received by me when I was sane and not mad, as I am now. Laws and principles are not for the times when there is no temptation. They are for such moments as this, when body and soul rise in mutiny against their rigor. Stringent are they, inviolate they shall be. If at my individual convenience I might break them, what would be their worth? They have a worth. So I have always believed. And it goes on. But I just think that's her thesis statement. That's Jane saying, this is wholly what I believe. And I think there's so much power in so many of that. The fact that she literally says out loud, it's about self-respect. I think mm-hmm. that's what I come down to. And it's kind of how I will answer our question at the end of this episode of, I don't know if I can respect myself if I give in to this and I go with him. And this idea that she's like, my entire life I've had this system of beliefs and I can't cast that aside because then what have I been living for? And I just think it's amazing. And I love that section.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think this is where I had sort of designated it as her no. Mm-hmm. Like this is, and I think, I hope, I sincerely, this is something that I sincerely hope that everyone who listens to our podcast and reads this book, and just everyone in the world, regardless, when someone asks them the question, who cares about you? I want your first answer to be, I care. I care about me. That is so critical to me in living a full and happy life. When someone asks you the question of who gives a shit about you, mm-hmm. Rochester is not doing that in a cruel way. Yeah. He's not saying you, who is going to care about you? You're going to go die on the moors. He's saying, who's going to care about me? Mm-hmm. I care about you so much, Jane. And I don't want you to go out in the world and experience the things that I experienced that made me learn that no one cares about me. And I have to find someone who will.
Yeah.
And Jane has this, the strength that we talk about lives and dies in this line. Mm-hmm. Jane cares about herself.
Yes.
And that is why she has the strength to do the right thing, even when the right thing might kill her.
Yeah. It's incredibly powerful. And it's why she's an incredible protagonist and role model and all of this stuff. And I got goosebumps like hearing you talk about that and reading that passage. Self-love is so important. And it's something that just in life in general, it's something I think about sometimes when, you know, chatting with friends of mine who have struggled with, you know, going through different relationships and things like this. And it's like, I know it almost sounds cliche, but it's like, you have to take the time to really learn to love yourself before you can love somebody else. And the fact that Jane has the self-awareness and self-respect to do that, to say, I will lose that if I go with you now, and I have to keep this, because if I don't respect myself anymore, then who am I? Right.
Yeah.
So that's amazing that she has that strength and that awareness.
Yeah. I think it's beautiful. And I think it's such a great character building moment. And I think, I don't know if we have seen that. I know we've seen the question. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've seen that answer in an adaption. And if this is one of the many instances, please always tell us when we're wrong, but this is one of the many instances where if you know that this is in an adaption, please tell us, because I think that this is a line that either I did not understand before, I have not seen. Mm-hmm. And I think that this moment is the piece that is missing in so many of the adaptions.
Yes.
The moment of Jane has these morals that she believes in that live in her. Now, I have my own feelings about, honestly, how I maybe disagree with her in this moment. Mm-hmm. But I think that nugget of the first thing is, the truth is yours.
Yes.
Is really, really, really powerful.
Agreed. And again, I think even like in a theology class, this would be a wonderful topic of discussion of mm-hmm. this kind of like these laws of man and these laws of like a good Christian life, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And do we let that rule our lives versus what we personally believe? But then if your self-identity and your self-laws are based in that, and that's what matters to you, then that is 100% justified. And that's what matters. But again, so interesting. Would love to discuss on a further deeper level.
Yeah.
But
the last thing that I want to talk about before we talk about our own live, would you leave, would you stay? Mm-hmm. The last thing that I have is just, and this is the moment that I thought of, we've talked about that idea of Rochester in a great adaption. Rochester comes in real hot, very sure of himself. The Rochester we've seen, very, very confident, being like, I'm just going to explain to Jane why I was tricking her into a bigamy, and then she's going to stay. And then Sirian Hines threw her suitcase down the stairs, and we were like, so close, but no. And we talked about in Timothy Dalton in the 83, he has this turn. And this is where I see that turn, is in that moment when she says no. And he finally, he believes that he has heard her. He believes that he has explained himself. He believes that he is understood, and he knows she's going to leave anyway. Mm-hmm. And the line that I highlighted that like just killed me is, he turned away, threw himself on his face on the sofa, Oh, Jane, my hope, my love, my life. Broken in anguish from his lips.
Oof. And I love that in the book, so, because like I've mostly been associating this scene in the book with the 80s version because it feels very close to me. In that one, she goes out into the hallway to leave him and he goes after her and they have this sort of interaction. In the book, he throws him, she's like gone out the door and he throws himself on the couch and he has this moment of like a breakdown and she's so heartbroken that she goes back to him, like kneels down and gives him a kiss goodbye and then goes to leave. And it's like, oh my God, which first I feel it like she's like, I can't leave you like this. I need to give you one more smooch. But also in my brain, I'm like, no, don't give him false hope. Don't come back. He'll think that you'll stay. And I'm like, oh, it's so tragic.
It has a very similar feeling to the 70 version, the 1970 one that we talked about with George C. Scott, where he says, just stay with me. And she sits down until he falls asleep and then she leaves.
Oh, I love that so much. That's one of and my that's favorite what goodbye.
That moment feels like to me.
It's beautiful.
I did accidentally skip the line that I think we've already talked about, so I don't know that we need to go back to it, but the one that we've talked about a million times, which is, I could bend her with my finger and thumb. What good would it do if I bent, if I tore, if I crushed her? Whatever I do, it is a cage, and I cannot, the savage, beautiful creature. And it is you, your spirit, with will and energy and virtue and purity that I want, not alone your brittle frame.
Yeah.
And I did skip parts of the middle of that. Those are, it's a freaking page long rant that he goes on.
So long. Oh boy. Okay. One of my last couple of notes, just, so for the most part, I'm all on board. There were a few things that I did not like. At one point, he refers to Bertha as that fearful hag. He also refers to Adele as that French dancer's bastard. And I'm like, bad, bad choice, dude. Not good for winning that points
French
here.
French bastard.
Also, when he's describing how he came back to England and he met her and like fell in love with her instantly, for me, it's a little creepy that he's just telling her how he like watched her without her knowing for a long time. I was like, that's a bit weird. But if you're into Phantom of the Opera, you probably love it. But my last note is about, I did a little bit of math here because I feel like we always discuss this, right? Big criticism. Jane, you dumb bitch. Why did you spend all your money on a carriage ride? And here's the math that I did to help kind of justify maybe what sad, depressed, desperate Jane is thinking. So to go as far enough away where Rochester won't have any connections to possibly find her costs 30, whatever the amount is. Let's just say pounds. Okay. It costs 30 pounds. Jane only has 20 pounds. So if she were to spend half of what she has to then have some money in her pocket to buy housing and food, she would not be nearly far enough away where it's not for sure that he would instantly find her and bring her back again. So I think it's simply her focus of, I just need to go where he can't get to me. So therefore I will spend every penny I have. If I'm going to justify this bad decision, that's what I come up with.
Well, and I think the other thing too, is like, we talk a lot about the fact that she's 19. What we don't talk about is the fact that she hasn't had anything to eat in 72 hours and she has barely slept.
Yep. She's had a few glasses of wine. So great. And drunk on an empty tummy.
I literally wrote, when he gave her wine, when she comes out of her room after days of not eating and sleeping and he gives her wine, like, first of all, you guys didn't understand anything about medicine. But he gives her wine. I literally wrote down LOL wine. Can you even imagine if, like, let's say somebody we knew had like a full emotional moment and they basically locked themselves in a room and they were at a point where we were considering breaking down the door to check on them and they'd been in there for like 36 hours and they come out and we're like, okay, we know you're hungry and thirsty. Have this glass of wine.
It's a moment that's always stood out to me in the 80s version, because when he brings her downstairs and she's all so like dumb. Faint, she asks for water and he brings her booze. And I'm like, no, bad choice. Like, you're not going to get your way by getting her drunk, Rochester.
It's like, that's so she then spends another like 12 hours, like kind of passed out because she got a bunch of wine on an empty stomach. And so she wakes up and she's like delirious.
Yeah.
And all she knows is she has to leave, because if she stays here any longer, she'll break and she'll stay with him, because that's what she really wants to do. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's answer the question.
Oh boy. I think at the core of it, where I relate most to Jane in this moment is her, what I read about this ideal of self-respect. It's a thing for me personally where, and I've said this from the beginning of having relationships, is if I was ever with someone and they cheated on me, and no matter how remorseful or sorry they were afterward, I could not, for my own self-respect, take them back. That is a personal law that I have in my heart. With this level of deception that he's laid before her, and then also everything that comes after, especially the info about the other ladies and how he feels about them now, I would also leave. That's my choice.
This was the sentence that I wrote down in my notes, which is, I think Jane needs to leave. I don't think Rochester is wrong. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't leave.
Nice. How would you work through that with him?
I think I agree with him. I see what Jane is saying. She mm-hmm. is saying, I have my own moral code that directly conflicts with that. And I cannot give this up for you. Mm-hmm. And I cannot break that, because the things that I think, I completely agree with the sentiment of, if the things you believe are right, when they are questioned or they're put in a position where you have to be uncomfortable to continue to stick with them, if you mm-hmm. break them and you don't stick with them, then what is the point? I don't agree with the fundamental way she creates those morals. I personally believe that figuring out what the right thing to do is what is inside of you and is what you feel the right thing to do is. And I personally feel like what she is feeling mm-hmm. is that staying with him is the right thing to do, but mm-hmm. she is letting society and religious rules and all of these other things make her believe that it's not the right thing to do.
That is, yeah.
I think that this explanation and this thing, now, would we have a very serious conversation, sir, about how you ever lie to me again? if you tell me that you put that letter in the mail and I see it on the counter later, I am out of here. Mm-hmm. You get no more lies, no fibs, no nothing. You say you took the dog for a walk, you took the dog for a walk.
Mm-hmm. And see, I think that's part of it for me, is I don't want to live the rest of my life with the man that I love waiting for that next lie to come. And I think a big part of my choice is centered on my fear that will inevitably happen. And I am very afraid of, like, being made a fool of and being disrespected, or like if someone tells me that they like me and then actually they don't, that would break my heart. And so I think, given everything I knew about Rochester, despite how I feel for him in that moment, I think I would be too afraid. I'd be like, I can't guarantee that you are genuine for the rest of time, and so I need to go. And there is no such thing as that actual guarantee. That does not exist in this world. But I need to go on believing that it can. And I don't think in that situation I can tell myself that. And so I think out of both personal respect and then also fear to protect myself, I would leave.
Yeah, that's so hard. I would definitely stay. This worked on me. I forgive him on staying.
I love I also this. Feel oh like, my gosh.
I also feel like, I feel like it would take some time for me to really trust him again. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I don't know that Jane really trusted him before.
True, true.
She knew something was happening and she felt weird about it and she didn't listen to her gut. And like, I am not blaming her at all for anything that happened. I just think that like, I would feel way more secure after mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. than the gaslighting. I don't think I'd forgive him for telling me everything was fine the night before the wedding.
Yeah.
This I would forgive him for. This explanation and this vulnerability, that vulnerability and honesty that we talk about, the like, mm-hmm. here is my heart.
Yes.
I also think that it is a difference of, I'm a grown ass woman. Mm-hmm. I have been through some stuff mm-hmm. and I feel very solid in who I am.
Yeah.
And so I think it would be enough for me to see his logic and his reasonings. And honestly, I think in this situation, I feel like my morals align a lot more with Rochester than with Jane, in that I don't want nobody else gets to decide what is right or wrong for my life other than me.
Good.
And I think that's what Rochester's saying.
I love that for you, Lillian. You're going to get off to his awesome villa and live on the Mediterranean, feeding each other cheese and wine.
And we're going to completely ignore all the problems of the world and just hang out with each other.
Cute. And Pilot and Adele will be there. It'll be great.
And I like his plan for just pay Grace a lot of money. Yeah. And have like enough. He thought about the fact that like, this is where this man is written by a woman. No man I know would have thought about the fact that Grace Poole is going to get lonely here and needs her family. Like, he's like, listen, she's got family nearby. We'll pay enough for them to stay nearby. Like, she will be fine. We will be out of here.
It is great. It is pretty great. Luckily, I do have the foresight of knowing that in this book, eventually, if I make this choice like Jane does, I'll get to come back with a fortune and he's all blind and handless. And I'll be like, I got you, baby. Be like, remember that time? In case you guys can't see this, but I am currently making it rain with money.
In case you guys can't see it. For those of you who have eyes into the past and our webcams.
I will make it rain all over that sad man, and I'll be like, I'm going to give you smooches because it's my choice, baby.
See, I think you end up with a lot more control. You have all the money and he has nothing. I end up with a husband who has both eyes and all his hands.
But I get a guy.
My uncle finds me so much sooner to give me all his money.
Amazing. Well, my guy gets a cool eye patch and he's really edgy. And we get him like a sweet, like robotic hand. It's really cool. So I've got a cool cyborg husband and you've just got a weird flesh man. So
that's so great. Well, I'm so glad that we had a chance to really talk through this chapter. Cause I think this is the most important chapter in the book. I think I said that at the beginning. I completely stick with that unless something St. John says really hits me, you know?
Classic St. John. You know, I think when you read the line, you're made for labor, not love in the book, I think it's really going to speak for you. That moment, you'll be like, now I get it.
Now I get it. Now, oh, you know what? I'm going to India with St. John. You know, I've always been a big fan of when you're doing mission trips, but it's actually for colonization reasons. I'm super stoked to go help out in colonizing India with St. John. Stoked for that for me. Because I'm made for labor, not love.
That's you're gonna get that as your tramp stamp.
We've talked about a couple of different reasons why we might do a Kickstarter. I think it's funny. I'll put made for labor, not love as a tramp stamp for like if you guys give us 10 grand, I'll get that tattooed on my ass.
Oh my god. More like if they fund $500,000 so we can make our own adaptation, then Lillian also gets the tattoo.
We need way more than $500,000 for our own adaptation. For $500,000, we can do our one act play of chapter 27.
Awesome. I love it. I love it so much. Oh, you guys, we did it. We went through probably the most important chapter in the entire novel and the reason why this book has existed for more than 100 years. It was worth it. Every single page and line, I loved it. And I adored talking about it with you, Lillian. There was so many things here that we unpacked that I didn't really think about until I chatted about it with you. And I hope that our listeners also found new ways to kind of look at this section. And
I feel exactly the same. I genuinely, there are so many moments with this podcast that we do where I'm like, I can't wait to talk about Piper about this. And I was having this moment of trying to put my thoughts together for this chapter. And I was like, I don't know that I've got everything sorted out. And I'm like, well, that's the point of talking to Piper about it. Because Piper and you sorted out together.
Yay.
And so I feel really joyful that we get to do this. And I'm thrilled that you guys bother to listen to these two silly ladies talking about whether or not we'd still kiss this man.
Because that's what it really comes down to, right? Smooch or no.
But next week, we are going to do two things. So first of all, I'm traveling. I'm going to my cousin's wedding. And for those of you wondering, do you have an objection speech written down that includes the words, I declare an impediment? Yes. I don't know if I'm going to use it or not yet, but I'm now ready at every wedding. Piper, keep that in mind.
Amazing. Yay. I mean, you'll be standing up there for me. So
What you guys didn't see is Piper just did the most intense eye roll because she did not find that joke funny. And the idea of me interrupting her wedding is not fun for her.
Well, because anytime we talk about Little Women, you are also like, hey, I might just like give this speech to you about how you should run away and not marry your husband. And I'm like, seriously, don't. I'm like, don't do that.
I think it's funny to, on your wedding day, say you will be interesting forever and you'll be bored of him in a year.
Great.
Even though you guys have been together for like 10 years.
Exactly. A decade and we're still having fun.
But what we are going to be doing because of that, because I'm going to be traveling this week, is we're going to watch the SNL clip that they have of, it's Jude Law in 2004. And SNL did a Jane Eyre skit. I would tell you about it, but I've intentionally not watched it so that all my takes are hot and fresh for y'all.
Ooh, I have to say, I'm so excited to see Jude Law, who I presume will be Rochester. Wouldn't it be great if he was Jane? but no, that sounds like a very steamy, funny moment. So I'm excited.
And then we're also going to play a little game called Would I Stay, where we're going to watch, or not necessarily watch, but talk about our sort of core Jane Eyre adaptions, and whether or not in those versions, Piper and I would stay.
Awesome.
So love it. If you want to play along with us, you can go rewatch all those stay speeches. And we'll be talking about that next week. And then we'll be back with a palate cleanser. Because I know a lot of our listeners are like counting and they're like, Lillian, it's supposed to be palate cleanser week. I know.
Yeah.
I have to travel.
Lillian has to go celebrate true love. And that takes precedence in all things. So
they've been together for a really long time too. And they're sweet. And I get to see my whole family. And I know you guys are jealous. And that's why you're sending us these mean emails in my head.
Can't wait. So if you want to follow along with all of this, you can find us on social. We are at Airbuds, just like the name of the podcast. You can also share your thoughts on this very intense chapter with us. We'd love to hear what you think about this. Would you stay? What is your moral quandaries and how do you deal with them? How do you perceive the world? Send us an email about it. We are airbuds@gmail.com. And if you can write a 5-star review and share it with friends, we would appreciate it, because the more people who join this party, the more fun that we have.
As many stars as you feel we've earned. Yes. We're open to very kind criticisms. It's okay. I can hear. I can take it.
See, I would also be very entertained if you left a 1-star and just said, they're stinky. And haha. And I'd be like,
I don't find that fun. I don't think it's a funny joke. I don't enjoy it. Piper would find it funny. I might cry. So just,
I would get a kick out of it.
Mm-hmm. Know that. Now, what I would laugh very hard at is if you gave us a 5-star review and said they're stinky. Yes. That would be really funny for me. I would love it if we got like 3 5-star reviews that just said they're stinky.
We're so stinky and we love you guys. And we're stinky for you. So
yeah, we're stinky for you because we love you.
So join us next week. And until then, you guys, happy Jane Eyre reading and watching. Bye.